So what I intend to do tonight is to take up five little couplets around which I'm going to try to focus my remarks relative to marriage. So first of all, I want to talk to you about origin and objectives. Where did marriage come from, and what was it supposed to do? What were God's purposes when He instituted marriage? What was God's objective? What are the reasons why God put this institution of marriage in place? Well, first of all, in terms of its origin, I don't think I need to spend a lot of time proving to this particular audience that marriage has its origin at the very beginning of human history, and it came directly from the mouth of God Himself. Okay, so those of you who are younger and at university, you will find a humanistic-based philosophy in the world that will seek to tear that away. Obviously, if you subscribe to humanistic theory and Darwinianism, then you have to have some way to explain marriage. And so marriage will be explained on some totally different foundation that will be based on sociological observations or principles, or the principles of anthropology that'll talk about how men interact with one another, and how marriage is a convenient institution that came along in certain cultures and certain civilizations, and it just sort of happened that way. I just want to state, I don't even have to prove it, I just have to state categorically, the Bible tells us that as to its origin, marriage came from the mind and the heart and the lips of God. Right at the very beginning of our Bibles, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, quoted by the Lord in Matthew chapter 19, quoted by the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, the Lord said that a man would leave his father and mother, would cleave to his wife, and the two of them would become a unit. The two of them would become one flesh. So marriage as to its origin is defined by God, and actually the strength, and I just want to pause here for a moment, the strength of those words in Genesis 1 and 27, male and female created He them, it's not just the fact that a man and a woman were brought together by God in a marriage. The strength of those words is actually one man and one woman. Now, of course, there only was one man and there only was one woman, but one man and one woman are to cleave together and they become one unit, one flesh in the purposes of God for their lives. So the scriptures are crystal clear that marriage is the union of one male, one man, and one female, one woman, brought together in the purposes of God and intended to remain together for the balance of their lives. Okay, that is not a Gospel Hall definition of marriage, that is not an ecclesiastical definition of marriage, that is God's definition of marriage as given in the Bible. Society may choose to define whatever it wants to define. It can define civil unions, it can define common law, it can define whatever it wants to define. Of course, it's not satisfied defining those now. It wants to actually attack and rob the very word marriage itself and redefine it. But society can do what it chooses to do with words and semantics. At its core, marriage originated with God. And it'll never change. What's its objectives? What were God's objectives? Why did God institute marriage? What's its purpose? Well, first of all, and these are not particularly in order. In fact, if anything, they're in reverse order. In Genesis, we're told that God said it is not good for man to be alone. So one of the reasons for which God instituted marriage was that when He created man in the first place, and I mentioned this last night, He created man with the capacity and with the craving and the need for relationship. Man was never created as a solitary being. He was never created to sort of go wander in the woods by himself, although some men like to do that. But generally speaking, woven into our fiber as human beings is the need for relationship. And God intended that that relationship would be reciprocated. And therefore, when Adam was formed, or Adam was created, and Adam was put in the garden, Adam was given dominion, when God looked at him, it wasn't an afterthought. God didn't look down and say, boy, I made this man. I brought all these animals to him. He's named them all, and he still doesn't seem happy. I think there's something missing. I got to do something. And then as an afterthought, He made woman. So for all you sisters here tonight, you're not an afterthought. I hope you're tremendously relieved to find that out. God's purpose right from the beginning was that there would be a reciprocal relationship, perfectly complementary, The idea of a help meet for him is one that is equal with him and perfectly suited to be joined to him, to be linked to him. So God's original intention in marriage was that it would be the institution in which two people would come together in a mutually complementary way, and they would enter into a closeness and an intimacy in a relationship that otherwise would not at all be possible. So marriage definitely is the institution in which the closest of all human relationships is going to be exercised. Secondly, marriage was intended by God, and is intended by God, to provide a stable, permanent, healthy institution or environment for families to be raised, for the world to be populated, and for His purposes to be brought forward. Okay, and again, sociology, anthropology, you take those courses at university and they'll have all sorts of other explanations. God's design for human existence to expand and populate His planet was the institution of marriage. One man, one woman, committed and joined together for life, blessed with children, accepting responsibility for raising and guiding and steering those children, and then those children eventually going out and doing the same. That's God's pattern. That's not just old-fashioned Victorian English ideals. That's God's pattern. Marriage is the stable, institutional building block for healthy, safe, fruitful, sustainable human civilization. Now, I'm not tonight at all interested in going down a path of talking about the social ills in the world and where we're heading, but I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to understand that instability, heartache, lawlessness, social ills, one of the great causes of those is the breakdown in the family unit. Not just the breakdown of family units in terms of divorcing and single parenting and all of that, but even within marriage units, the breakdown within those marriage units, when there is dysfunction and abuse and neglect and all of those things. Stable, functioning families, the way the Lord designed them, are the essential building block for human society. But the third and perhaps most important reason that God has given us this institution of marriage is to show us, to model for us and in us, the relationship that He had always had planned between Christ and His church. That's the truth of Ephesians chapter 5. Okay, so for some of you younger believers, I want you to sort of grasp this, because sometimes you can read Ephesians chapter 5 and you'll think what God's trying to explain to us is He's trying to explain to us the relationship between Christ and His church, and to explain it in a way that we might be able to understand, He looks down into human experience and He says, okay, I'll try to explain it to them this way. I'll tell them that it's sort of like a marriage. That thinking is totally backwards. Okay, God wasn't, I want to say this reverently, God was not struggling to try to explain to us the relationship between Christ and His church, and then just sort of selected marriage as a way to show it. It's exactly the opposite. God had in His purposes a bride for His Son. And in those purposes, God envisioned a relationship that would exist between His Son, who would sacrificially give His own life and shed His blood, and pour Himself without reserve in order to procure His bride and nurture her and bring her along, ultimately to glory. And as God looked at that, the relationship between His Son and the church, His bride, God put marriage in place to model that truth, not the other way around. And God put marriage in place to give us the opportunity to actually live that truth in our lives. So the great spiritual lesson in marriage, for those of us who are married, the great spiritual lesson is we are to be living out. That's really the teaching of Ephesians chapter 5. We are to be living out in our marriages our appreciation and our understanding of the truth of Christ and His church. So as a husband, it's not that I'm to love my wife if she's lovable. It's that I'm to love her as Christ loved the church. And as a wife, it's not that you submit to your husband if he's reasonable. It's that you submit to your husband the same way that the church submits to the headship of Christ. And if husband and wife both recognize that, we are given a tremendous privilege in imperfect bodies, still dealing with the sinful flesh, still in a scene of sin and temptation, we are given the privilege of modeling in our lives this sublime relationship between Christ and His church. And I would suggest that's probably the greatest purpose for which marriage was given. The others flow from that. It is a stable institution, and it is the way for our needs for intimate relationship to be met. But principally, it's a way of us understanding God's desire for the relationship between Christ and His church. Okay, so the first, we'll have to move quickly. The first then is origin and objectives. Origin of marriage, it comes from God. God's objectives in instituting marriage, to provide for our needs relationally, to provide a stable way for human civilization to populate the world, and to show us, to model in us, the relationship between Christ and His church. The second couplet that I want to stress, relative to the scriptural teaching on marriage, is leaving and cleaving. Now, any of you that have listened to Sandy Higgins' messages or read his book, Marriage and the Family, if you haven't, I would strongly advise it for every young couple, even older couples for that matter. Very, very good teaching. I know Dr. Higgins was here 10 years ago, I don't know when. I listened to the recordings off the website. Excellent teaching, and if you've heard his teaching, you will know that leaving and cleaving is one of Sandy's great headings that he uses. We read it 3 times. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. What is the meaning? How do we understand? Why is it so important to stress? Well, first of all, the leaving. You're going to understand what marriage is supposed to be. You're going to have to understand the principle of leaving. And the word leaving is actually a very strong word. It has the idea of leaving behind. It has the idea of actually separating from something and starting in a direction and leaving behind permanently what previously had existed. Now that doesn't mean that you abandon your father and mother. It doesn't mean that you abandon all prior relationships. But it does mean this. It means that when you take the step of marriage, you are leaving forever the nature of all the relationships that you had before. None of them will be exactly the same anymore. Now it's really important that you understand that. Some of you who are not married, and some of you maybe perhaps who are recently married. Because marriage changes previous relationships. Prior to getting married, if you're a young man in the meeting, you may have had a mother that just doted over you and thought the sun rose and set on you and catered to your every whim and texted and called you 15 times a day to know exactly how things were going. If that's the case, then God help your wife. But once you get married, your relationship with your father and your mother is going to change. It needs to change. It doesn't mean that you're going to be disrespectful, absolutely not. But it does mean that the closeness and the level of interaction and the involvement and them being the first ones that you'll turn to and them being the ones that the first time adversity comes along, that's the safe haven that you go running to, that's going to change. It has to change. That's actually what leaving means. And for some of you dear sisters in the meeting, it's the same thing. I know this is given to the husbands, to the man, but the principle is really the same. When you're in your father's house, you are under the headship of your father in that home, in terms of the scriptural pattern. When you get married, your previous relationships have changed forever. And you have now entered into a new unit that God recognizes with different headship and different relationships. Now, could I just take a second to say, for those of us who are parents, let us understand and let us practice the requirement that our children, when they're married, are leaving. Never interfere in the marriages of your children. Do not give your child, if you have a young somebody in their 20s and they're recently married and they're running into those first few arguments when they realize that this knight in shining armor that they married actually has a few ugly warts. It's fine if they want to talk to you, but you know the best advice you can give them? To go back to their husband and talk through it and communicate. Give them that advice. Just because you're missing them and just because you're struggling to adjust to the fact that they've kind of flown the coop and left the nest, and the first time they come running crying back to you, the worst thing you can do is to open their arms and stroke their heads and tell them, open your arms and stroke their heads and tell them that, oh, he's so mean to you. You never should have left me. You should have stayed here. I would have helped. That's not helping. Okay, now I'm overstating it to make the point, but the point is valid. Leaving is the first important principle for a couple when they're getting married. They are entering into a relationship that is fundamentally changing the relationships that they've had previously. Now, that same principle could go beyond parental relationships, I would suggest, even to friendships. And we'll touch on that a little bit later in terms of closeness and intimacy, and all of those sorts of relationships change a little when you get married. Don't abandon them, but they adapt, they change. So that's leaving. What about cleaving? Cleaving is also a very strong word. Cleaving has the idea of things being welded together. That's really the most common way that the word would be used. Now, a weld, for those who know anything about metalwork, which I don't know a tremendous amount about it, but it's a permanent bond. Okay, if you want to bring two things together that at some point in the future you might want to take them apart, think of a vehicle. Okay, you don't weld your rims onto the hub, right? You don't put your wheel in place and then weld that onto the hub, because you know at some point in the future you're going to have to remove that wheel. So you put lugs and you put nuts and you tighten them all up, because at some point in the future you're going to come along and you're going to undo those and take them off again. Cleaving is not nuts and bolts. Cleaving is welding. It's the idea of two things being brought together and being so inseparably glued or welded together that the very word itself implies the irreversibility and the inseparability of two things that previously were distinct. That is the idea of the word cleave. So I want you to get this principle clear in your head. Leaving and cleaving. It means it changes all prior relationships and it puts you into a relationship that in its very foundation, in the language used to describe it by God, is irreversible and is permanent. The third couplet that I want to stress is roles and responsibilities. This is a vast one, and I certainly don't have time tonight to do it much justice. So I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, what is the scriptural role of the husband? And this is perhaps one of the areas where society's norms and modern expectations and modern practices have most infiltrated our mindsets, if we're honest. It's the area where they have encroached most into our perception of what is normal. What is the role of a husband? What is the role of a wife? What's their spheres of activity as God has designed it? And please don't jump all over me. At least if you're going to do it privately. I'm a very fragile person. So I would like to state what I believe the scriptures teach relative to God's intention for the spheres of service and the roles of men and women. God's role for a husband is headship and leadership in a home and in a family. Now, what is headship and what is leadership? Again, Sandy Higgins, and I'll quote him. Sandy has a very, very good quote about headship. He says, "Headship is not authority over someone or power over someone or even responsibility to someone. Headship is responsibility for someone." So all you men in the audience, if you want to know what God means when he says that you are the head of your wife, get into your minds this idea that what God is really saying is you are responsible for your wife. You are accountable to God for the welfare of your wife. That's what headship really at its core means. Now, in the context then of a marriage, that is a very, very serious thing. Because what that means then is that God holds me answerable, not just for my own spiritual condition, not just for my own walk with Him, not just for my own actions or activities, but God holds me answerable, and God has placed responsibility in me for the physical needs, the material needs, the emotional needs, and the spiritual direction for my wife and my children. Think very carefully about that. You younger husbands, think very carefully about that in terms of your actions. There may be things, there may be activities, there may be attitudes, there may be mood swings, there may be interests that you have that you think that you are free to just pursue. You're not. Not without thinking about the ramifications on your family. Spiritual leadership is, I should just touch on material leadership and providing. Obviously, that maybe that's the area that we're most If we're good at anything, maybe we're good at that. Most of us who are husbands and fathers, we take pretty seriously our responsibility to provide for the home and provide for the material, spiritual, physical needs of our wives and children. We should. However, I think we should have a word of caution there. Very often, we think that what we're doing is providing for the material and physical needs of our family, when really what we're doing is leading them down a materialistic, covetous lifestyle. And providing for the material needs of my family is not working 70 hours a week to try to maintain a lifestyle that we simply can't afford to maintain. So providing for physical material needs is definitely important, but providing spiritual leadership for the home is absolutely critical to this idea of headship. So if you're a man in your 30s or into your 40s and you've got a wife and you've got a couple of children and you become totally disgruntled with some other brother or some other sister, and you're not getting the due you think you deserve in the assembly, and your nose is out of joint, and you're becoming really disgruntled and can't be bothered making it out to the midweek meeting anymore, and actually seriously thinking, if they don't soon realize how valuable I am and how much they're missing by not having me in a place of responsibility and giving me more place in the assembly, I just might leave. I'm not making that up. That, I think we're all mature enough to understand that happens. The devil gets a man in that position. If there's anybody here tonight and you're anywhere close to that position, could I implore you in God's name, think about headship. You are making decisions that will have drastic ramifications for the spiritual welfare of your wife and your children. And you know who's responsible for those decisions? You are. That's what headship is. That's what leadership is. And the principal role of men in a marriage, husbands, is the role of headship. And remember, it's responsibility or accountability for the welfare of those the Lord has entrusted to you. The principal role of women, wives, mothers, is submission. The sphere in which that takes place is primarily the home. Submission is not bowing to some ogre. It's not cowering in fear under some tyrant. Read Proverbs chapter 31. You notice that the woman in Proverbs chapter 31 opens her mouth, not to nag, not that anybody would do that, not even to complain, but she opens her mouth to speak wisdom. And a wise husband will have a wise wife that gives him counsel. Submission is not cowering under totalitarian leadership any more than headship is exerting totalitarian leadership. Submission literally means taking your place under in an orderly way. That's really what the word submission means. And if you want to understand the illustration of that, that is the way in which Christ is subject to his Father. Okay? The head of Christ is God. The head of the man is Christ. The head of the woman is the man, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Christ is in no way inferior to God. I say that reverently. But for the purposes of God to be fulfilled, Christ put himself in a place, in an orderly structure. He put himself in a place to follow the headship of God for God's purposes to be fulfilled. That is what a wife does in a healthy, scripturally based marriage. The sphere of her operation, I don't have time to go into it, but you read the passages for yourself. Read Proverbs 31. Read Titus chapter 2, verse 4, where we read. Read 1 Timothy chapter 5, where we read. And you will find that the emphasis on a godly woman serving in a marriage, in a family, her sphere is the home. She keeps the home. She provides in the home. Her home is a place where believers are welcome and hospitality is shown. Her home is a place where children are raised and they are nurtured and they are nourished. Her home is the sphere where she functions for God. So while the husband is the place where God has put accountability, the wife is the place where God has really designed for, if you want to use business terms, it's program delivery. Okay, so the husband has to answer for what's going on, but really the wife, and I mean, I'll say this honestly from the platform, I think my wife could survive pretty well without me. Those who know her would probably agree. As long as there was life insurance to pay the bills, I think she could probably manage okay running the house without me. I wouldn't last a week without her. She runs the house, and she does a really good job of doing it. But she, when my girls were smaller, I have two girls, when my girls were much, much smaller, I had one thing I simply couldn't do. I did my best with very clumsy hands. I tried to change diapers and I tried to help and I tried to do all sorts of things. There's one thing I could never do. I never was able to comb the girls' hair or brush their hair. And so I used to tell Rachel that if she ever died, I'd have to get married before the next Sunday so that I'd have somebody to do the girls' hair to take them out to meeting. Fortunately, the Lord hasn't taken her, so that's good. And now the girls are big enough to do their own hair. But the sphere of service for the wife, for the mother, is in the home. Now, does that mean that woman should not work or cannot work? No. Read Proverbs 31 again. I think the woman in Proverbs 31 quite clearly was a woman who did have responsibility beyond the sphere of the home. But I would say this, her responsibilities beyond the sphere of the home did not change her basic responsibilities and actions for what was taking place within the home. That was her principal responsibility, and any outside interests took second place to that. So the modern practice where there's husbands and wives with equally important roles, with equally ambitious career plans, with equally competitive ambitions, with equally valid professions to follow, very difficult to see that fitting into the scriptural pattern for marriage. Okay, so I don't know most of you, so I'm certainly not over here throwing stones. But I am asking you to seriously look at it. And if your career aspirations and your desires for professional development and your need of fulfillment is totally going to be derived from being a career woman with all of the feedback that that involves in the world, I think you need to take a good solid look at marriage the way the Bible defines it. Because that may be a convenient way for you to live in union with another man, but it really isn't the scriptural pattern for marriage. So I'll leave that and I'll move on. I'm happy to talk privately afterwards to anybody that's got questions on it. But I would suggest that the roles and the responsibilities that we have in the scriptures relative to husbands and wives are laid out as leadership, headship for the man, submission, and caring for the home for the woman. That does not mean demeaning, it doesn't mean inferior, but it does mean intelligently respecting what the scriptures teach. Now the specific instructions that are given in terms of responsibilities to make that work is that husbands are to love their wives, and wives are to be submissive to their husbands. Now I don't have time to go into those any more than I have, but let me just say for the husbands specifically, and I find this extremely searching myself, do you love your wife? Now you say, well, yeah, of course. Okay. How do you define that? How do you measure that? 1 Corinthians chapter 13, I was mentioning to Michael, I had to speak last weekend at Jackson Conference in Michigan, and one of the messages I spoke was on just one verse, verse 7 of 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And I would encourage all of you husbands that are here, even the ones older than me, I'd ask you respectfully, go to 1 Corinthians 13, set aside half an hour or so, and look at 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7. And that's just the end of all the attributes of love you have in that chapter. But in verse 7, we read four things about love relative to all things, all circumstances. It says, love bears all things. And love believes all things. That would be the opposite of suspicion. Love hopes all things. That's the opposite of cynicism and despair. Love bears all things. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things. Love endures all things. And then ask the Lord to help you to look at your own life and your own relationship with your wife and then say, do I love my wife? Or am I the type that puts the worst spin in every situation? Am I the type that my wife is afraid to tell me anything because I'm just going to snap at her? Am I the type that when I come home from work, I've just had such a stressful day that I'm walking around and not just with chips on my shoulders, but with logs on my shoulders, daring anyone to knock them off. And my whole family is walking around tiptoeing on eggshells in case they upset Dad. And my wife is just a bag of nerves because she doesn't want me to fly off the handle. And then ask yourself, do I love my wife? Okay, because this is very, very searching. And that truth, the 1 Corinthians 13, that type of love is used twice in the New Testament as a pattern for us. Once in John chapter 13, in a general way to the disciples, the Lord says, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you're to love one another. You know the other place that it's used specifically? Where we read in Ephesians chapter 5. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. So the great responsibility for husbands is to love their wives. Fourth couplet, because I got 8 minutes. Fourth couplet is commitment and communication. If I was to ask most of you young, starry-eyed, romantic dreamers in the audience, those of you not married and those of you just married in the last 12 months who haven't had a chance to get cynical like the rest of us, if I was to ask you what is the most critical thing to succeed in marriage, what would you say? Most would say love, right? All you need is love. That was an English fan song, a Beatles song. Is that all you need? Is that even the most important thing in marriage? Is marriage basically all about Hallmark cards and love and the nice little plaques that Michael promotes all over England? Could I suggest to you that the most important scriptural principle for marriage is not love? In fact, it's very interesting that the command to love your wives, or in Titus, to love your husbands, is actually given to those who are already married. You know the most important principle in marriage? Commitment. Commitment is the absolutely vital principle underlying the biblical definition of marriage. Now again, to quote Sandy Higgins, page 26 of his Marriage and the Family book, if you don't have it, I have one copy, I'll auction it off to the highest bidder. What holds marriages together is not love, but commitment. An unconditional, unbreakable commitment made before God and witnesses to take each other as husband and wife. I sat, some time ago now, I sat with a man 4 or 5 years younger than me, married, a few children, and his marriage was, to use the colloquial term, his marriage was on the rocks. And there had been pretty serious breakdown between him and his wife. And she had left with the children. And he was just sort of teetering. He was on his way to meet with his wife. And very unwisely, he had been given advice by a number of people in assemblies that the best thing he could do was just cut her loose and let her go. That the way she's treated you, it's not right. It's, you know, just let it go. Just. And he called, wanted to meet with me at Tim Hortons for coffee. We met and we had coffee. And I did my best to try. And I have a world of respect for this young man because he has proven over the subsequent years that this is exactly what he has done. Calling him by name, I said, you know, marriage is a commitment, first of all, to God. Okay, so when marriage troubles come along, you're very focused on interrelationship problems. You're very focused on the other person. You're focused on your wife. Or if you're a woman, you're focused on your husband. And your whole sense is there. We just don't love each other anymore. We've just drifted apart. We just don't understand each other. They've really hurt me. I can't seem to reach her. I can't. We're very focused here. Can I suggest to you the framework for understanding commitment in a marriage begins like this. I love the Lord. And because I love the Lord, I love His Word and I love the truth of His Word. Because you cannot love the Lord without loving the truth of His Word. And because I love the Lord and I love the truth of His Word, I respect the institution of marriage as He has defined it in His Word. And because I am committed to the Lord and I am committed to the truth of His Word, I am therefore committed to my marriage as an institution before God. And because I am committed to the Lord and committed to His Word, and therefore committed to the institution of marriage, I am committed to my wife. The fact that I love my wife, because the scriptures tell me to, is great, it's good. The fact that I enjoy being with my wife is certainly healthy and should be normal. But it shouldn't be the basis upon which I rest my commitment. My commitment is to the Lord, to the truth of His Word, to the institution of marriage, and within that framework, to my wife. And if I follow that wholeheartedly, and again, I hesitate saying it because God knows I could be tested on this and far better men than me have fallen. But I trust with God's grace I'll be able to live this out in my own life. Commitment is the essential underpinning to marriage. Communication. Communication is, if you listen to people that are very experienced in broken marriages, they'll tell you this is the number one cause of breakdowns in marriage, is communication drifts apart. So let me just very, very quickly run through in 2 or 3 minutes some things about communication. First of all, what is communication? Communication is really the exchange of thoughts and ideas. Okay, so it's not so much just words, it's words are a part of it, But effective communication, okay, and this is not meant to be a business seminar or secular teaching or anything, but I think we can all understand that effective communication begins with things that I think in my mind. So I have thoughts and ideas and visions of things, and I want you to have those thoughts and ideas and visions of things. And so I take those thoughts and ideas that I have in my mind, and I put them into words and actions and however else I choose to communicate, and I relay those to you. You take those inputs, and you process them through all of your social filters and all of your attention spans and whatever other filters you have, and eventually all of those inputs translate into thoughts and ideas in your mind. Effective communication is effectively transferring what I had in my mind ultimately into your mind. So that goes for preaching as well as marriages. But so therefore, I think we can see that effective communication is actually really tricky. Okay, and they'll say like words are only, I don't know the percentages, it all depends on what study, but they say words are only about 15% of effective communication. The rest of it's body language and tone of voice and frame of mind of the speaker or the listener or whatever. In marriage, you've got to remember that communication is absolutely essential. And communication has not been effective until the person that you're communicating with actually understands what you meant to communicate. Let me turn that around. Communication is not really effective until you have accurately understood what the other person meant to communicate. Now, let me just speak to husbands. This is incredibly complicated and tricky. Okay, because if you have wives, I'm going to say if you have wives, that would really be bad. If you have a wife or if you have daughters, you will know that it's never simple. So you come home and you say, how was the day? Great. But you sort of stop and drop everything because it wasn't great, it was great. Well, was the day great? No, the day wasn't great. How do you know the day wasn't great? Because she said it was great. Well, it wasn't great because of the way she said it was great, right? So if she just doesn't even break stride and she just doesn't look up, fine. Well, as a husband, you've got to know, no, the day wasn't fine. There was something wrong. And you are probably not going to find out what was wrong by just proceeding into your study and catching up with all the emails you couldn't respond to while you were driving home. You're going to have to stop. You're going to have to pay attention. And you're going to have to wait. There's different levels of communication, right? You have sort of the cliche communication that we all share in, right? I shake hands with you, I said, hi, how you doing? Do I really want to know how you're doing? Do I really intend you at that point in time to let all your veils down and all the barriers away and pour your heart out to me about the deepest longings of your soul? No, I really... Please don't. Right? So we have this cliche level of communication where we sort of interact with one another in a healthy way, but we have certain sort of barriers, and we're like onions. We have all these layers that... Then there is informational communication, where, you know, we sit down around the supper table and we start asking, you know, how the day was, what happened. We exchange information. Husbands and wives, especially once children come along, they exchange, you know, this one's got to go there, this one's got to be picked up there, this has to be done, that has to be done. We exchange information. But I think any one of us, if we're honest, really, would have to acknowledge that true intimate communication is what most often first starts slipping away in marriages. Because you're too busy. Because you've tried to communicate and they just don't get it. And you have tried to open up. And could I just say, you're vulnerable when you open up. Absolutely you are. When you genuinely, especially maybe after you've been married just a little while and you know, there are some things that really are bothering you. And the initial bloom of the wedding has passed and the honeymoon's over and life is settling in and maybe your wife's very lonely, maybe she is missing her family, maybe you're missing your mom's cooking, whatever it is. There are some things you need to talk about. And you need to take the time. And you need to put in the effort. And you need to remember that it's not what's being said, it's what's being meant. And you've got to learn how to listen. Now, I don't mean by intimate communication, I don't mean like, I don't know, whispering love words in your ear. I mean real, honest, genuine communication. So again, I would say as a husband, do I communicate with my wife? Now, those who know my wife will know if I didn't, she would certainly set me straight and let me know how she felt. But do I genuinely communicate? Maybe the better question would be to ask her if I do. Or do I have a wife that feels as though she is virtually frozen out of my busy life? And as I run around like a hamster on a wheel, she's doing her best to keep things going at home, and I'm just this sort of distant person in the periphery of her life. You know, that's sad if it's true. But I think it is sadly true in an awful lot of marriages. So commitment and communication, there's a whole lot more could be said on that, but we will leave it. The last thing I'll say in terms of a couplet is focus and faithfulness. I stressed as we were reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, his own wife and her own husband. Now I know that there in the context it has to do with physical intimacy, and I know the specific teaching that's being given there. But could I just stress as the meeting ends tonight, focus on your own wife. If you're a married man in this meeting, if you're a married woman, focus on your own husband. Focus on your own marriage. Now there's a whole bunch of ways that that can be applied. Don't be terribly occupied about other people's wives or other people's husbands. Don't allow your marriage to be defined by what you wish it was, like so-and-so. You know, so-and-so's husband does this. You know, so-and-so's husband buys her roses and every day that ends with Y. And you bought me a toolkit for Christmas. That's not healthy. Well, it's definitely not healthy to buy your wife a toolkit for Christmas, but it's not healthy to be focusing on everybody else and everybody else's issues and everybody else's marriage. Focus on your own husband, your own wife. Focus on the scriptures. Focus on the scriptural definition of marriage. Focus on your personal responsibilities within marriage. Do not allow all of the distractions out there in the world to take your focus away from your responsibility for your marriage. And finally, faithfulness. There are physical, emotional, and spiritual needs that God has intended will find their answer, will find their fulfillment within a marriage union. And only within a marriage union. You guard very, very, very carefully making sure that those needs are never met outside the sanctity of marriage. Okay? Now, I don't want to be anything less than discreet from the platform, but when it comes to physical needs, a man's and a woman's, physical needs for sexual intimacy are to be found within a marriage. That means that you are not going to be seeking to satisfy or gratify those sorts of needs through pornography, through any relationships outside of marriage, or through any other way of feeding those appetites other than within your marriage. Your emotional needs, your spouse should be your most intimate companion in terms of you pouring out your soul to somebody. Should be. Awful lot of marriages suffer because people at work start linking up with a soulmate and they just understand me. And you know, my husband is so cold and so distant, and I try to explain and he doesn't understand. And suddenly the devil brings someone into your life that you're just able to link with. And you just seem to bond. And the things that you have tried so hard to explain to others that they never understand and leave you feeling so frustrated, this person just drinks it in and they understand you and you seem to be able to connect. And before long, you will find that you are now finding that need for intimate emotional connection being met by somebody other than your spouse. Is that going to help your marriage? It's going to make it 1,000 times worse. And it's going to cause this drifting to continue. So as I close, 7 minutes over tonight, this is getting worse and worse. As I close tonight, could I just ask you, focus on your marriage. And ask the Lord for help to be faithful. Not just in a technical, compliant kind of a way. I've soldiered on with a stiff upper lip for 35 years in a miserable marriage. No. To be faithful to your wife, to be the husband that God intends you to be according to His Word. And to be faithful to your husband, if you're a married woman in the meeting, according to the teaching of Scripture. Let's pray.